from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. On the surface, the story of Paul English resembles that of many successful tech entrepreneurs. Awkward software engineer turned billionaire. But author Tracy Kidder's A Truck Full of Money goes beyond that stereotype and digs into English's complicated relationship with money and his day-to-day life with bipolar disorder. Nearly 35 years after Kidder's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Soul of a New Machine, examined the world of computer hardware, Forum talks to Kidder about Paul English and the new age of tech entrepreneurs, and that's next, here, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tracy Kidder joins us in studio for this Forum hour. Author of Mountains Beyond Mountains, Strength in What Remains, and The Soul of a New Machine, the writer the Baltimore Sun called the master of the nonfiction narrative, he recently published A Truck Full of Money, One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. It's a rags-to-riches story of a software engineer and entrepreneur by the name of Paul English, a genius billionaire who suffered from bipolar disorder and who, though no fool, wanted to be parted from his money. We welcome Tracy Kidder back to the Forum program. Pleased to have you with us.
Thanks, Michael. It's nice to be here.
Well,
he's not a billionaire, by the way. He's just a multimillionaire.
Well, I thought... he sold his company for...
The company was sold for about $2 billion, but he only... $120 million stuck to him.
I'm sorry. We have to decide if Trump is a billionaire, too. We have to see his tax returns.
I wonder.
Well, he's a fascinating character, and I want to find out about him and have our listeners find out about him. But I first had to ask you, because there seems to be a notion that there's a logic to your going from The Soul of a New Machine, which probably many of our listeners know, which was published back in 82, to from going from kind of hardware to software.
Yeah, there was something to that. It was partly just my curiosity. I had left that world. I fled from it in a way back in the 80s, partly because it seemed like everybody expected me to keep on writing about it, and I wanted to look at the rest of the world. But I got curious, and I knew this guy because he was associated with Partners in Health, Paul Farmer's organization. And
Paul Farmer being the subject of your book, Mountains Beyond Mountains.
Correct. Yeah, sorry. Right. I wanted to see it again. You know, I had lots of things had passed me by. I had never tweeted. I still haven't, actually, although I have two imposters Twitter or whatever it is. I thought it was pretty fascinating. And he was my guide for a while, and then I thought he ought to be my subject. And I'm glad of that. In the end, you know, the view of the world that he gave me was less interesting than him to me, you know, but that's often been the case for me.
Well, it is a fascinating story. I mean, let's go back to the early part of this story. I mean, he was a young working class kid from Boston, reminded me a little bit of Good Will Hunting because of the genius, and it clearly was. I mean, a computer genius early on. He's hacking his teacher's computer. doing a pot business as a kid. I mean, so there were always these strains of the entrepreneurial and
rebellious too,
and the computer and rebellious. Yeah, I mean, seventh grade, he's doing Boston Latin. He's hacking and going away on this stuff. And the fact of the matter is that. The seeds of who he would become, you know, it's like Wordsworth said, child is father to the man, were there, and you captured that early life.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I worked hard at that. It was confusing. I mean, his own account of his early life it contained a great deal of violence. I mean, a very angry kid. And he told stories about, you know, really having some terrible fights and really hurting some other kids. This was interestingly, I thought, many of his friends, and particularly one old girlfriend, just didn't recognize him in that portrait. They said they can't be. And I certainly didn't in his current form. This is a guy who is so placid in traffic. It just blows your mind. I think it's partly that he worked hard on this anger of his. He does that. He's You know, he's not an English major. He's an engineer. So he takes seriously the possibilities of that great self-help library of America and self-improvement. And, you know, it's tempting for an English major, like former English major like me, to smile at this. But, my God, it works. I mean, he's amazing in traffic.
Well, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about it also maybe in terms of his Roman Catholicism. We had Larry Nye on recently, who did a biography of Robert Kennedy and talked about how Robert Kennedy, you know, was one of the Joe McCarthy acolytes and was somewhat vicious by many people's standards. And then he went through a reformation like your guy.
Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, there are schools of thought that say people can't change, but he clearly worked on himself. And he, you know, he did it. I had it from an interesting guy, a philosopher, a trained philosopher who'd seen him at this large software company where he really began his career. We saw him come in as an arrogant young, sort of typical young programmer, arrogant and testy and so on and so forth. And then a few years later, he's suddenly looking at him and the guy is helping to manage this entire big company. And people seem to like to work for him and he seems judicious and patient. And he went to him and asked him, how did you do this? And Paul English said, well, you know, I realized that the brash young programmer wasn't working for me anymore, so I read books and tried to change. It's amazing. I mean, most people can't do that. He's a man of enormously strong will, and this is in spite of the fact that he has suffered, was diagnosed in his mid-20s with bipolar disorder. And it was pretty profound. I mean, you know, that's a diagnosis that's all too widespread and a big pigeonhole and so on. But in his case, I think it clearly applies. He had terrible bouts of depression for a number of years. He kind of eschewed the medications at first. He eventually solved that problem with the help of a psychiatrist. They found a drug that really worked with minimal side effects for the depressions, but the hypomania recurs and was still recurring when I started following him around. And it was it's a powerful thing inside a person. I'm not sure that it, you know, he would say it helped him in some ways in his work and it hindered him in others, I think. But the fact that he could master himself so thoroughly, even in the face of this powerful inward drug, as it were, I find that admirable and interesting.
Well, you do write about his bipolar disorder. I think it's safe to say that it varies from person to person. And
yes,
there's all these questions about genetic links. In fact, not only to bipolar, but you raise questions about genetic links to programmers and people of that disposition like he had. But he talks about being on fire and swarms of bumblebees. I mean, you know, the sense is very palatable about what he's experiencing psychologically.
Yeah, it's very powerful. He said, you know, it sort of reminds him of the onset of an automobile accident where you're suddenly everything is tingling, except that it goes on for a long time. And it would make him the upside of it for him was that he could work for weeks focused on one thing and sleep a couple hours a night. So it just added to his energy. I must say, though, he has abundant energy even without it and enthusiasm, but maybe one of the downsides is grandiosity, that it seemed to him that he could conquer everything. And I mean, he's not an arrogant person at all, but it would seem to him that he could, you know, it's almost every even the loopiest ideas were bound to succeed.
So we used to call the Hannibal syndrome. You think you can climb over those Alps and do whatever you need to do to get things accomplished. And he did accomplish a great deal. I mean, in addition to kind of bringing empathy into the picture of what he was doing later on. Yeah. I mean, he started out, let's just talk about this, mostly known for kayak.com, which he sold for nearly a couple billion, which is, I guess, why I thought maybe he made. But he also sold, that was the Priceline in 2012, he sold an Economic Forum in the 90s for $33.5 million. And the fact of the matter was, this is what makes him so fascinating, I think, to you and me both, is all of this money notwithstanding, he took an attitude. Money's, you know, to be moved around.
I don't have the quote right in front of me, but basically, you know, he said to me several things about money. One was that, you know, when I grew up, we didn't have any money. Why do I get to have money? I don't feel comfortable about it. He also said, you know, money's a fiction, right? Money's supposed to move around. It's supposed to facilitate trade and other things. So hoarding it, he thinks, is a disaster. It's not that he doesn't live a nice life. He has nice places. He really loves cars. He's got some great cars. But he's mostly interested in money as something to give away. And he's an engineer through and through, and he wants to find the most effective ways to do it. Right after Kayak was sold, he co-founded Kayak. He was not the sole founder. He put a pretty large chunk of money into an irrevocable charitable trust and then imagined that he would make lots more and by the end of his life give everything away, like his hero, this guy named Tom White. But
who was like a father figure to him and a like mentor.
A Boston construction tycoon who had really financed the work of Partners in Health.
Philanthropist, major philanthropist.
A major philanthropist and a lovely guy.
So there's the influence of the books he read as well as Tom White's influence.
Yeah. Well, I think it was mostly Tom White. You know, I mean, and his own – this is a soulful engineer. This is a guy who does not like to witness suffering in other people. And his immediate impulse is to try to do something about it, you know. He's not the kind of person who finds it easy to walk past a homeless person, for instance. I mean, he's got his nerve endings are there, you know, right out there. And right now, I mean, at the end of my story, he finally finds that there's a waywardness to the time that I spent with him. I just by happenstance happened to hook up with him to start writing about him or to start following him around right around the time Kayak was being sold. And he was also really on a hypomanic run that lasted, you know, it was intermittent, but it lasted for a couple of years or so, I think. And I think, you know, there was a fair amount of confusion. You had to try to start all over again. It's not the kind of problem that brings tears to your eyes, but it's a real problem. You know, how do you start again? What are you going to do? And he went on some pretty strange jags. I mean, at one point, the funniest one is when he decided to buy a lighthouse. To make a bid on a lighthouse that was up for sale. It's the most seaward lighthouse in Boston Harbor in it that has no plumbing, no electricity. He loves parties, and he thought this would be a great party place, even though it had no plumbing or electricity, or the fact that to get to it, you had to climb a 30-foot ladder. And then, you know, the next morning when he woke up, he thought, what have I done? But he didn't. But somebody in Boston was crazier or had some other purpose for it because someone bid more. I mean, and he felt rescued. He started a company and got obsessed with The Office, which he really wanted to make into a work of art. And I think he succeeded. But the business almost for a time almost seemed tangential to this. So he's always
interested, for example, in building a team.
And that's what he's really great at. His greatest skill has been building teams of these software engineers. Now, you know, he grew up. There's a wonderful man whom I had the great privilege to meet, a professor emeritus at Stanford named Donald Knuth, probably the greatest living computer scientist. Some people say he's the person who made computer science into a real discipline. But Knuth has a hypothesis that he said he got from someone else, that 2% of humanity has always been equipped to be great programmers of computers, even before computers existed. I mean, he has a wonderful line about how I think that the people who built the pyramids would have, 2% of them anyway, would have been great computer programmers if there had been computers at that time. And Paul clearly fell into that group. He was a super coder. And he had some of the – he likes to say that a lot of his best – the best programmers he knows are sort of like him. The term he uses is shy often. That is, they feel socially awkward to one degree or another. Of course, it's very dangerous to generalize. I'm not doing it. He would do it. But these are not people who generally like dealing with what they call suits, you know, with the business end of things. That's not uniformly true. But Paul could do that. He taught himself. He trained himself in spite of what he calls his shyness to be able to bridge these two worlds. And I think
– And despite his bipolar disorder too.
That's true. I think that's of great value to a lot of programmers. Somebody else who keeps the PowerPoint presentations away from them, you know, keeps them out of the business meetings and some of those kinds of hassles. He also is extremely generous. That company that he started that you mentioned, the $33.5 million, he started that right around the time of the dot-com boom. And, I mean, he was basically financing it with his own credit cards at a certain point when he finally managed to sell it. Now, any sane person, I think, would have said, geez, I'll sell it to you for my credit card debt. But no, not Paul. He held out. He bargained hard, and he got himself the $33.5 million. And then he turned around, halved his share and distributed among his 15 employees. And you know, you remember that if you're one of those employees. I mean, he had all these people who would, I'd say, I forget how many, I mean, at least a dozen whom he called 20 pluses, people who had worked for him on and off for 20 years.
Well, also the people you mentioned, like Bill O'Donnell and Paul Schwenk, part of the Three Amigos, who said, we're going to hitch to this star because it's going someplace and it's going to make us all rich. And indeed it did. We're talking to Tracy Kidder, who his new book is A Truck Full of Money, One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. And that subtitle is certainly very important here in terms of understanding the subject that he, Paul English, who is the subject of the book here. There's that question, in fact, does programming affect strange people, attract strange people, or does it make them strange?
I don't think there's a clear answer to that, you know. And strange to us, perhaps, those of us who have no talent for that. I tried, by the way. With very little success.
Well, there are a lot of stories about these young programmers, you know, who are computer geniuses or that 2%, whatever, who wind up making fortunes and everything. His story is distinctive in many ways, but I'm wondering, you really get into the whole sense of in the book, and it's important to many people, particularly out here, of startup culture. I mean, because he's...
Mm-hmm. That's what he's doing.
Really, that's what he's doing, right. What did you learn from studying him in terms of the startup culture that really might be particularly important to convey to listeners?
Well, I think there are several things. Unfortunately, it's also surrounded by cliches, sometimes known as memes, although I suppose not all memes are cliches. One of the things about startup culture is I think there's a poignancy to it. There seem to be a huge number of young people for whom starting up a company is more than about trying to start a company, becoming an entrepreneur, building apps and so on. This has become almost like a religion. You have to brand yourself and so on and so forth. And the opportunities are much more limited than you might imagine. I mean, it's very hard. Sooner or later, if you're going to start a company, you're going to have to find significant financing, and it's hard to do. It can be very hard to do. And, you know, I got the impression his company, the company that he started after Kayak and has since folded up, was soliciting ideas. You know, there was going to be a so-called incubator. And was soliciting young people who wanted to start companies.
Are you talking about Lola or Blade 20?
No, this is Blade. Okay. And they... I mean, most of the stuff that came in was really kind of poignant. I mean, it was as though all the really good ideas had been used up, and now you had to settle for, you know, better kind of automated pet doors for people with small animals, or, you know, tons of parking apps that, near as I could tell, wouldn't help much of anybody. All of that said, you know, it's a little bit like the profession I chose, and if you really want to do it, I'm sure you can find a way. I did sometimes feel as though I was looking at a bunch of highly educated people who were behaving rather like kids in playgrounds in cities, you know, who dream of becoming pros. They didn't wanted to start companies. Now, if you do get into that, there is always the prospect of failure. You know, almost. I forget what the exact statistics are, and it depends what venture capital firm we're talking about, because some venture capital firms get much better
prospects. Well, I found out from your book that a venture capital firm has to do a lot better than about 2 times its investment.
Way better, because most of the investments are going to fail.
So it's a big gamble world, really.
It's a big gamble world. It really is, and it's chasing really big gains. You know, Kayak was a big gain for a lot of people, but nothing compared to, say, Facebook or eBay or any number of other ones. But I think one of the things that this guy exhibited, there's a meme that says fail fast and pivot, you know. And that could be a license for acting irresponsibly with other people's money. But it also seems like an important prescription. He could take – I mean, when he decided something was not going to work, he could drop it without remorse. You know, cut his losses fast and move right on. You know, like it was a morning's bother. And psychologically, it helped, of course, that he had the cushion of great success at this point. But earlier in his career, even before he had that, he was able to do that, able to turn away and to start something else. It's a You know, it's I think in my book I talk about this being a really old ethos that predates the digital era. The notion that you don't have to do what your father did or even what you yourself were doing 6 months ago or even yesterday. And this does seem to me, you know, if you look sort of back historically, look at Henry James's book, The American, look back at de Tocqueville. This does seem to have been a particularly American trait of the businessman, you know.
Is it also maybe, and maybe we'll hear from listeners on this. I mean, I mentioned his attraction to ideas of empathy, even started Empath, which is a program
at Kayak.
And he instituted it. And empathy and computer science usually don't necessarily correlate in many people's minds, do they? I mean, you know, I'm going on a limb here, obviously, and like you say, generalizations are dangerous. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, he went to Haiti to work with Haitians, right?
And Paul, he actually has a big program now called Summits. It's a wonderful, potentially wonderful program. I think it's going well, where they've taken over about 41 public schools that Partners in Health used to run and trying to improve. Their first aim is to do a lot better teacher training. These are all in a very impoverished part of Haiti called the Central Plateau. And that's going to be his big project for a long time. He's also bought the land to build a first-rate high school there. And they're doing some notably smart things there. They've gotten some of the best advice you possibly could get. And they're teaching – the courses are being taught in Creole as well as in English.
But see, I have to ask the question about what makes someone, particularly from his rough background and family troubles and, like you say, a lot of violence and everything, although I love that story about that guy named Psycho that you tell in the book. This is he hacked and he got the school attendance records, and this guy who they called Psycho was a truant, but he won his allegiance by essentially eviscerating the record of so-called Psycho's attendance record. But you know, you have to ask what motivates someone to not care about money, really, and to think money can be used for good things as opposed to, you know, I'm going to – like you say, he's got cars and everything else. But really, money is to him something that's dispensable and that needs to be used in positive ways.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I do remember a moment where he turned to me. He was talking about fundraisers for organizations and being feeling uncomfortable among rich people. And I remember looking at him thinking, so you still think you're not rich?
What are you? Yeah.
But – and I think he doesn't feel that he is rich. Even though he is, I mean, in some deep way, I you know, but Michael, I don't have the answer to this. I don't know what makes some people generous and others not. I think we all have some altruism in us, you know, we're born with it. I don't know. So I'd like to think.
We're down to a minute here, and I want to take the opportunity to invite listeners to join this conversation that we're having with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tracy Kidder, who examines the mind of tech genius Paul English. Be interested to hear from people about the minds of engineers and programmers. We're also talking, of course, about bipolar disorder, touching on a lot of issues here that are related to Tracy Kidder's new book and the study of Paul English, a fascinating figure. Also like to hear from some of you in the startup culture and venture capital, because there's an interior look in those worlds as well. Let me invite you to join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments, bring them forward. Again, toll-free 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Tracy Kidder, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and he has a new book called A Truck Full of Money, and it looks at the life of Paul English, a software engineer turned multimillionaire. Tracy Kidder steps beyond that stereotype, digs in a Paul English's complicated relationship with money and his day-to-day life with bipolar disorder, and also pretty much presents him as part of the new age of tech entrepreneurs. And Tracy Kidder, by the way, will be appearing tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Dominican University for a talk and a book signing sponsored by Book Passage. On Thursday at 6:30, he'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And in the meantime, you can talk with him here on the air. We do welcome your calls and emails. You can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment. You can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We welcome your involvement and invite it in the program. And subtitle of the book is One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. This is a man who, by the way, was at one time driving a Tesla for Uber dressed as a vampire, just to give you an idea of perhaps what an unusual man he was. Want to say something about that, Tracy?
No, he didn't. He wasn't dressed as a vampire, but he was – yeah, that's right. Yes, he did it for fun. I just think it's
drove Uber.
Kind of hilarious. Yeah. Well, he did it first for research for this new company that he started called Lola. Which was going to have customers rate the actual travel agents. And so and Uber does that. So he thought it would be interesting to see how it felt to be rated by your customers. But he really got into it for a while. He was keeping a journal of all the interesting things people had said to him. I did a little journey with him when he was staying customers in. It was hilarious.
You also did a kind of journey with him. You were on a plane with him and he showed you all the domains that he had bought.
Yeah, we had some time on the flight and He over the years, I think 20 years or something like that, he had collected all these domain names. You know, you don't actually own them, you rent them, but he had. And these were all ideas. These were the best of the ideas that he had literally dreamed, in many cases, dreamed up for software enterprises and other things. But generally, there was software involved somewhere in these things. And the whole flight, I mean, I think it was about 4 or 5 hours, I just sat there taking notes and he was describing each one. Sometimes he'd come to me and say, I don't remember what that was, but it was something really cool, you know. It was really an interesting thing. The guy has got a great, as he likes to say himself, a great taste for shiny new objects and ideas. They just keep coming to him. I think it's interesting that his biggest score, Kayak, wasn't somebody else's idea, not his. But he didn't care about that. I mean, you know, for an engineer, execution is everything anyway. But on the other hand, you know, all the shiny new objects, all of this, you know, he's a man with a very peripatetic mind. He always had several projects in process, or, you know, but he is also capable of enormous concentration on one. Very paradoxical guy in many ways. Hard to pin down, which just makes it fun, you know.
I mean, it's certainly fun for you. It comes across in the prose. And let's find out what our listeners have to add to this conversation or questions and comments you might have out there. Harry, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I am very impressed by this generalization idea. You guys say it's dangerous between somebody who has autistic disorder, not saying disorder in the sense of the spectrum, which gives you skills in computing, and the bipolar disorder. I'm a psychiatrist by profession, and I come from that part of the world, South India, where a lot of the IT professionals are everywhere, and they seem to specialize in that. It's kind of genetically selected, and the system directs them in that way, too. So they're very successful, and there are a whole lot of them in the Bay Area, San Jose Valley. But lately I noticed that the general thing was in India, the southern people are very intellectual, they employee, they work for someone, they're not good at management. And then I see people like, I actually had a friend who kind of transitioned that way, and I could see in him, he didn't have bipolar, but he transitioned through veterinary science into becoming a big IT chief because they saw something in him and they just taught him IT and then promoted him all the way to the chief of information technology in a bank. But anyway, this Pichai, the gentleman who is the chief of Google, is another example. I don't think he has bipolar, but he just kind of transformed from a great IT mind to top of the pyramid in Google. So I don't know what that transformation in him. He's a very young gentleman. So I'm very impressed by a few like that are beginning to make that IT to management transformation.
But I don't know quite what that has to do with mental illness. You know, I do resist the notion, and I'm sure you do too, that there's something, the romantic notion that there's something, that mental illness is somehow a necessary ingredient for creativity.
For artists particularly,
I think that's ridiculous. And probably damaging.
What about the idea, though, that you hear from time to time that, and Harry, thank you for that call. We'll get to more of your calls in just a moment, but you do hear that a lot of engineers are supposed to be on the other spectrum of autism, maybe Asperger-ish or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, again, it's so hard. When you put people in these boxes, you sort of rob them of their humanity. And I mean, I know people who probably would be described that way who I find just utterly charming, delightful. They have
But what you said about social skills, though, for
yeah,
example.
Well, I mean, Paul told me he knew engineers who were so unworldly. He insists that this is true, that they have this acronym, BMW, that which they're so unworldly that when they had to go out to a restaurant, the simplest sort of restaurant, they had to use this acronym. The B was the bread, meant the plate was on your left, had your bread. The M was your meal in the middle, and the W was the water to your right. That seems a little extreme, but he swore it was true.
And we'll brought another caller here. Let me go to you, Joe. You're on. Welcome.
Hey, your guest mentioned altruism briefly earlier, and I was wondering if you encountered during the course of your research stuff about Richard Stallman, possibly the most altruistic among all programmers.
Oh yes, absolutely. Stallman is actually the hero of one of the important characters in my book. I did not talk with Stallman. I read a lot about him. Stallman started something, Michael, called the Free Software Foundation. And it's a little complicated to try to explain it, but it is not exactly the same as the open source movement.
That's what I thought of.
It's close, but in many ways they are similar. I think Stallman would object to any kind of suggestion that they're the same, and he'd probably be right. But it's been enormously important. Both of them have been enormously important. They've made it possible to start companies with relatively small amounts of capital, in the sense that, you know, there must be trillions of dollars worth of software out there that you are free to use. The difference between Stallman's view, Stallman's notion, and that of the Free Software Foundation is that he wants you can use all this software, but you are never allowed to license it yourself. And that is to prohibit other people to use whatever you produce from using that software. Whereas the Free Software, I mean, it's complicated. I'm sorry, I'm not saying this very well. But yes, he was great. And, you know, Tim Berners-Lee, who created the very simple and elegant software for the World Wide Web, rather than patenting it and keeping it for himself, he decided to give it to the world. He and Stallman have been, they are altruistic in that sense. Paul English's altruism is slightly different. It's not like he's trying to move technology to save Haiti or to deal with homelessness in Boston, although he'd be happy to do that if he thought it was appropriate. What he's trying to do is figure out the best ways he can help alleviate suffering. And
so that's really the core of his philanthropic ideal.
Yes, I think so.
To alleviate suffering.
To alleviate
and reduce
suffering. Absolutely, yeah.
And money can do that.
Money can do that. Of course, you have to – I mean, I just think he has very tender nerve endings for other human beings. It's an interesting bundle of things.
He's a good guy. I mean,
he is a good guy.
Somebody might accuse you of doing hagiography here, you know, making him into a saint.
Not.
But I don't see that. I think, I mean, he's also a teacher at MIT, so he cares about, you know, education. He cares about many things. It has a kind of, at least from your profile, humility about him, which is really
one of the things that sticks with me most of all the time I spent with him, we were out on homelessness rounds with this legendary Boston doctor who given his life to caring for the homeless in Boston. And at one point, Paul, on our rounds through the city at night, came across a guy who was bipolar himself, and Paul sat on the bench and chatted with him about this. And his thoughts, as he later recounted to me, ran along these lines. I mean, he had some friends who had been telling over the last year, couple of years, that, you know, the money he'd made from Kayak made him feel uncomfortable. And his friends would say, several of them at least, the way he recounted this anyway, would say, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. You worked hard for your money. Paul's retort, the one he thought of there sitting on the bench with this guy, who, you know, his counterpart, as it were, was, but I didn't really work that hard. I'm just good at something that makes a lot of money. That is, I dare say there are a lot of tycoons out there who would never say anything like that, even if it's true.
I dare say you're right. Let me go to more of our callers, and let's go next to Greg. Greg, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hey, I was just calling in because I'm an Uber driver, and it's funny because I shuttle a lot of venture capital people, and people are looking for venture capital, and, you know, all the different ideas that I hear that are coming down the pipeline. Yeah, it's kind of scary because some of this technology is just the amount of jobs that it's going to be wiping out is it's really frightening. I mean, as an Uber driver and truck drivers are going to be, out of work, it's 8 million people To my surprise, they're working on software that will basically eliminate computer programmers, software mm-hmm. engineers, and, you know, the like. And it's just like, they're creating no jobs, you know, and it's, technology is great, but it's just, you know, at the cost of, you know, there's going to be no consumers to buy anything.
I'm not a great expert on this, and I know that it has concerned the likes of Bill Gates, among others. But I do think that it's a lot of this partakes of futurology. So, you know, and particularly the future is clearly a mug's game, particularly when it comes to technology. I mean, how many things just don't come true? I mean, it looks to me like Google Glass is a dead issue, and I'm not so sure how you're ever going to have self-driving cars all over the roads until you figure out a way to make all the cars self-driving. I don't know. I'm sort of skeptical. I also noticed that one of the things Paul English did with his new company, Lola, is he decided to reintroduce the human being back into, you know, booking travel online. And so this is a company that will actually use real travel agents. You'll actually be able to deal with a real human being. You know, we have pretty sophisticated processors sitting on our shoulders, what often has been described as the most complex structure in the known universe, our brains. You know, even the least of us has that. And I don't know. It doesn't seem to me – well, I hope that the future you're afraid of doesn't come true. It has to some degree.
It's an ongoing battle that I think – I go back to Jeremy Rifkin, you know, who wanted to be a prophet in his time and was talking about all the elimination of jobs fairly early on. And, you know, people were calling him Cassandra and, you know, mm-hmm. Chicken Little and all the rest of that. I mean, it hasn't gotten as bad as perhaps he saw it, but it certainly remains a major problem. You say that some of this involves just sort of maybe a visionary or a prescient sense and then following it through. You know, like I make money because I'm talented at this, and, you know, he's talented in doing it. I mean, he kind of knew what fishing was before fishing with a PH and was doing it before anybody else was doing it.
He did it for himself, actually. I mean, I think others had probably been doing it, but he never – when he went to Boston Latin, he was a seventh grader. He decided – he was a rebellious seventh grader, and he – but he decided to join the computer club, and he got down in there, and he had this. He learned a little bit about how to code a computer. These were dumb terminals. There was one central computer. These are primitive setup, and he had there was an instructor or the leader of the club, a faculty member. And one day, Paul happened to be looking over his shoulder and saw that the menu this guy had on his when he brought up his when he turned up one of these terminals on. Was had a lot more stuff in it than he did, and he just thought, I have to have that. And he figured out a way to make up a dummy program that would be fed into that this guy would use, and then Paul would get his password, steal his password and username, and it worked.
He did, yeah.
And when he finally opens it up, Michael, when he finally, you know, he takes that password, he goes off and he looks it up, and he sees that this enormous list of things the guy can do, and there's one that really stands out for him. It's called attendance. And from then on, for the next 6 years, he and his friends, with the help of Psycho, who did the old-fashioned theft of a nurse's stamp, with the help of Psycho, if you were friends of Paul and Psycho, you could play hooky with impunity as a rule.
And we're talking with Tracy Kidder, and he'll be at Dominican University tomorrow at 7 and on Thursday at 6:30 at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And you can join us in a conversation here. Again, our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Or comments and questions, welcome on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and you can also email us, forum@kqed.org. Let me go to more of your calls. Well, welcome, Wynn. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you. Your talk about 2% really started me thinking back to the 1960s when I was a programmer, and the IBM equipment had a big problem in the sense that division was very, very slow, and the index registers were very fast. And in a program I was writing, I needed to know the difference between 32 and how much was left over every time I divided by 3. And I figured out, I took the time to figure out the timing and everything and found out that the index register worked three times as fast as division. And I was thrilled. I went around and told all the programmers who were all turned on by the way we were able to do something unusual that had not been allowed originally in the program, allowed for in the original program. And I was thrilled. And for two or three weeks, I went around with a big smile on my face because of that. Now, that qualified me as one of the 2% nuts?
Probably. I don't know, but that's a nice story. I you know, all the people I know who were around long ago, back when with software, when it wasn't such a terribly valuable commodity with, you know, with walls around it and so on, talk about how much fun it was to just be part of this group that was figuring stuff out and sharing it and so on. And that basically is what Stallman is all about, just trying to preserve that to some degree.
And we thank Wynn for his call. I'm going to go to another caller in a moment, but Robert writes, I want to thank Tracy Kidder for the book House, which I enjoyed immensely years ago. And Ula writes, speaking about people who are natural coders even before computers, please mention every weaver throughout history. A loom was the first computer.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Leslie asks, could Tracy please describe Paul English's connection to Paul Farmer and Partners in Health?
Sure. I'll be glad to do that. Paul's hero was the main early financier of Partners in Health's work, Paul Farmer's work, and Paul Farmer and Tom White were very close.
And Paul Farmer, we should mention, you know, is a doctor who set up AIDS clinics and other help for people in, as you were indicated earlier, some of the most impoverished areas of Haiti. But he also
All over the world
in
now.
Siberia. And,
Now in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea with the Ebola stuff. But Paul English, the organization saw something in him that they wanted. Not surprisingly, he wasn't such a terribly rich guy at that time. But he was a significant donor. At one point, he actually donated $1 million to Partners in Health when he was living himself on borrowed money. He found Paul Farmer extraordinarily inspiring. I wouldn't say they're close friends or anything, but the impact that Paul Farmer had had on so many people was something that appealed to the engineer in Paul English, and he did join the board, and he did, which put him. And he remembers very quite soulfully, I don't think I've wrote about this, but the day when Paul Farmer gave the board of Partners in Health a lecture about what it was like to die of cholera. This is during the awful cholera epidemic in Haiti, which still isn't entirely over. And he started crying silently, trying to hide it, felt embarrassed by that. But he then subsequently was at a meeting where he suggested that they try using some of the vaccines, you know, to help the efforts to try to staunch this epidemic. And others wanted to do it on the board, but they wondered, where's the money going to come from? And Paul English said, I'll backstop it, meaning I'll put up the money if need be. And it was a significant act. I mean, because it ended up leading, you know, Partners in Health followed through. It ended up increasing the supply of vaccine in the world. The vaccine, by the way, though there were some people who criticized this, the vaccine was perfectly safe. And
some people really think any vaccine is not safe.
And really quite safe. Yeah. Quite safe and quite effective. And it probably helped. I think actually helped quite a bit. In the end, the Red Cross got shamed or into putting up the dough, and Paul didn't have to put up the money. But that's the kind of relationship he's had, which he's not executing the work of Partners in Health, but people like that, and he and Tom White are necessary part of the organization. You know, that being a donor and a smart donor is not an unimportant thing, given the way the world is set up. I feel. I mean, it's certainly not a substitute for private philanthropy, in my view, and I think in Paul English's view, it's not a substitute for things like, you know, for public programs. I mean, imagine. You can't imagine Medicare or Social Security being privately financed. But given the fact that it's the only game in town, a lot of ways, if it can be done well, I have no problem with it. I'm off onto another subject.
No, you're making a very important statement about philanthropy, I think. And I wanted to get you on the record on something else from that caller we had before, who was talking about, you know, technology eliminating jobs and so forth. Another important thing that came across to me in your portrait of Paul English was a deep concern for the usefulness of a product for the consumer.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, not that he hasn't gone off on some jags, I mean, or some of those domain names of his don't record ideas that were perhaps not of very much use to anybody, but they never built. But yeah, he at Kayak, he really felt. Look, the guy was a consumer advocate from get go. He from early on, and when his father was slipping into dementia, he got furious when his father would call and talk to these robots from the likes of Comcast and Verizon and so on, and he decided to start this little blog, which turned into a company that he called Get Human, and it was all a collection of techniques to get around these robots and actually get to talk to a human being at those companies, and that company's still in business, by the way. He kind of gave it to a young protege of his. Meanwhile, at Kayak, he really wanted customer service to be emphasized, and he was running the engineering team separately from the business one, and he actually insisted that his programmers, these incredibly expensive fellows, mostly fellows, actually, you know, answer some of the complaint calls and some of the complaint emails in the hope that would inspire them perhaps to help fix the problems that they had created.
And get more human connection, which is a lot of what he was
about. There's this hilarious thing in there called the red phone. And it was an old-fashioned telephone. It would ring really loudly. And engineers were supposed to answer it. By the time I got there, he had been forced to create a little consumer team within the engineering team, but he would still answer the phone. I think he kept hoping that engineers would, but there was only one other who would. But he'd answer it. He'd get on the line. He'd say, "Yeah, I'm Paul English. I'm actually one of the founders of Kayak. You know, look, I'll try to solve your problem." Then he might spend 15, 20 minutes on the phone with someone. And his theory was that an angry customer is a passionate customer. If you can turn him around, then you've got yourself an ally.
Listener who says, your conversation about the loss of jobs due to automation should be considered in light of the exponential change in tech. It's easy to discount the idea of automation replacing workers, but unlike mechanical automation, computers will think one day.
Well, perhaps that's true, but, you know, it depends on how we define thinking. And I don't want to discount it. I do think that perhaps the loss of manufacturing jobs in this country has a lot more to do with outsourcing and with, you know, globalization, the destruction of unions, than it does with technology so far. But, I mean, I don't discount it. And I don't know what artificial intelligence may someday amount to. Computers thinking? Perhaps they already do by some definition of thinking.
Let me bring another caller on board here, and we go to you, Ben. You're on.
How are you doing?
Hi.
So I have a kind of an interesting perspective on this. I was 23 years in tech, having worked at Apple, Adobe, and a whole bunch of startups, and was a product manager, so I was all this responsibility, none of the authority. And I also have a son who is on the spectrum, and I was aware when I was in tech how many of the people that I was working with were, you know, especially the engineers, were on the spectrum.
You're talking about bipolar spectrum, or are you talking about autism?
Autism.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
I've come to a very interesting conclusion about this. A lot of the people who were on the spectrum who had enough either enough skill as programmers or who had become some of the heads of various startups were given a tremendous amount of leeway in terms of issues, in terms of their personalities. For most of the spectrum people that I know, they're able to be charming, they're able to be really, you know, quite lovely until enough pressure gets on them that it starts to put them into dysregulation. And when it's your startup and there's no one who is able to sort of contradict you in a way that makes you feel less, that allows for a lot more freedom of action. Flip side of that is that, you know, it is a hidden disability. They come across rude. They come across as saying things inappropriate where there's not the obvious you would never say to somebody with you'd never hand a pencil to someone with no hands and ask them to write. And yet with, you know, a lot of the spectrum folks, they're expected to behave in ways that are sometimes invisible to them. And they don't get that, they're sort of not given that normal break unless they're in a situation where their skills are so valuable that people are willing to put up with it, or they're the person in charge. And so, you know, you assume that, you know, well, whatever quirks, you know, startup people tend to have a lot of quirks.
It's really good to get your observations here, really, Ben. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Tracy Kinder, go ahead.
No, it's really interesting. I agree. I mean, I've seen – that sounds like something I've seen. The one thing I would say about my subject here is that as a manager, he was quite aware of all of this and sympathetic. And he tried to do – he tried to make people feel – you know, the hierarchy in Hayek and the engine, maybe it was an advantage that they were separate from, they had actually physically separate offices, the business and the engineering offices. And in the engineering offices, you know, to be on the spectrum was no great disability, I think. I mean, except as it probably always is. You were given abundant freedom. The one thing was you weren't supposed to work on weekends or late at night. And you actually could get reprimanded for that. Believe it or not, you weren't supposed to have meetings of more than about three people. And they weren't supposed to go on for too long. I mean, these were all things that most coders don't like. You know, anyway.
Well, let us leave it there. Tracy Kidder, always good to have you with us on Forum.
Appreciate to see you, Michael. Yeah.
And a book, again, is A Truck Full of Money, One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. And you can meet Tracy tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Dominican Talk and Book Signing, sponsored by Book Passage. And on Thursday at 6:30, that's Dominican University in San Rafael. And at 6:30 in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, he'll be there. Thank you for being here. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. General manager, Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.